Hello, and welcome to the Pre-IPO Liquidity, Tax, and Legal Considerations webinar presented by Pulcinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to our moderator, Derek Weber, Managing Partner at Saxon Weber.
Thanks, Emma, and welcome everybody to the event. We really appreciate it. Today's going to be an informative event just based on the volume of questions that I get every day from folks, mostly executives at tech companies looking for answers on the sale of private securities. And so I can't think of two people better to answer questions and to present a comprehensive view of that topic, both from the legal and tax point of view as the two speakers today. We have Dan McAvoy coming up, both from Pulcinelli. Dan McAvoy is a shareholder at the law firm of Pulcinelli, where he advises on transactional and regulatory matters to a wide variety of clients, including investment advisors, fund sponsors, individuals, investors, across companies from startups to Fortune 500. On topics in M&A, fund operation, and management out of beautiful Miami, Florida. We also have Ed Hannon. Ed's an attorney and a CPA. His concentration and his practice is on providing advice and counsel to clients on the use of various tax saving structures, and also works with members of Pulcinelli's corporate and transactional practice in connection with stock purchase agreements, things like asset purchase agreements, also broadly across many sectors, including tech and real estate, and from the equally beautiful Chicago. And as Emma introduced, I'm your moderator for this event. My name is Derek Weber. I'm a managing partner at Saxon Weber, and we're a secondaries-focused investment bank and brokerage firm. Before I kick off and turn the microphone over to Ed, I think it's super important to say that this is a topic that is generally understood, but the specifics are quite complicated. And so it really does take a bit of nuance and quite a bit of acumen to kind of weigh through it. And so the questions that we receive and the ones that we direct towards Ed and Dan for client support, really run the gambit U.S. and other countries' tax rules, to sales, specifically sales of securities prior to an IPO. I mean, that's specifically what we're going to discuss today, dealing with transfer restrictions and also an overview of the liquidity structures. I'm going to do my best to moderate. There have been many questions sent in advance. I think from what we can see when we compare those questions to the presentation, they're mostly answered. If anybody has some questions that are unanswered, please make sure to get them through the online portal, through chat, through email, however you'd like to convey them. And I'm more than happy if they come to me to make sure that they're forwarded to Ed and Dan to be answered. So without further ado, I'd like to, as I've introduced the two speakers, I'd like to pass the microphone, if I can, to Ed Hannon. And Ed, take it away. Thanks so much.
Great. Thanks, Derek. Thanks for the great introduction. I'm going to cover the tax topics and what we've put together in the slide deck. Hopefully will be useful even after this presentation. Attempted to break it out into a threshold question of what do you own, and then to identify the various categories of tax that can come into play. So, as the slide says, what you need to know is what is it you own? The difference between stock and options, it's fairly obvious, but is your option a non-qualified stock option? Is it an incentive stock option? And what we'll talk about is that, the incentive stock option is subject to special tax rules, but you, as the owner of that option, can do certain things that could make those special tax rules and tax benefits disappear. So that's what we'll cover today in the tax cost section, and then we'll go on to the more practical questions. But really, since tax is a big driver in a lot of this analysis, I wanted to make sure we covered that first. So this slide is our menu of taxes that can apply. And, you know, I hate to use the word tax menu because nobody wants to order off of this menu, but I think it's a helpful summary of what will come into play in the decisions that need to be made. So if you have compensation income in connection with the exercise of an option or a sale of restricted stock or issuance of restricted stock, that compensation is going to be treated as ordinary income, taxed at regular rates. For federal income tax purposes, their marginal rates that top out at 37%. To the extent that you are an employee, there's going to be employer withholding taxes, and we'll talk about those at length on why those are difficult not to get withheld if you're an employee. Obviously, if you were an independent contractor, a 1099 person, there will not be employment taxes, but there will be self-employment taxes that get imposed. We'll talk a little bit about long-term and short-term capital gain. The long-term capital gain rate is generally imposed at a flat rate at 20%, but to the extent that the gain is from a sale of stock or sale of options, there's also going to be this net investment income tax, and that's imposed at 3.8%. And then you cannot forget about state taxes that will come into play, and we'll talk about those in some detail. So let's drill down on compensation income, and we'll talk a little bit about when that arises in the context of incentive stock options, non-compensatory stock options, and restricted stock. But if you have compensation income, like I said, you're going to have tax at regular rates. You can have employment taxes apply. You can have state taxes, and note that your state of residence will impose the tax, but there's also other states that will say, well, if you lived in this state when you earned that income, we can also tax it. So, you know, that's where the state tax discussion becomes a little different. For non-U.S. individuals, there can be a home country tax as well. Many tax treaties eliminate that double tax, but something to keep in mind. So again, this is just sort of an overview of the language we're going to talk about. Capital gains on the next slide. What do we mean when we talk about capital gains? Well, there's long-term and short-term capital gain. If the holding period of the asset that you're selling exceeds 1 year, you get the long-term capital gain rate, that 20% rate we talked about. Now, when you have options, the holding period for the stock doesn't begin until date of exercise. So that's important to keep in mind when you are talking about a pre-IPO liquidity. What are you selling? What's your holding period for that particular capital asset? And as
I just wanted to interject there. I mean, this is sort of every day. I mean, when we're working with clients, I think maybe half have unexercised options, and really they're weighing a bunch of decision sets, which I know you're going to cover, but it's so routine in terms of potential sellers trying to come up with a tax strategy against the backdrop of unexercised options and trying to really get a feel for the whole period to reduce taxes and against the backdrop of whatever's going on in the market and with the company. So I just want to emphasize that it can be a difficult set of decisions to make, and any advice and counsel and a set of options that you can provide would be great. But I see that almost every day, and I know probably many of the folks tuning in have those questions in mind. So just want to highlight that.
Yeah, no, that's great. And we're going to go through each of those in the context of what do you own? Because quite frankly, if it's an incentive stock option versus a non-compensatory stock option, the answers will be different. So, you know, there are some things, and just want to sort of quickly go through this just to level set on, you know, when we talk about that's compensation income, why everyone should trigger in their head compensation income. There's a ton of tax on that. Or we talk about capital gains, that there is a lower rate available if I hit a long-term holding period. So those are really the two key decision trees of, number one, how do I minimize or avoid my compensation income? And number two, how do I maximize my long-term capital gain treatment if I can? So Derek, that's a great question. Want to go through the next examples. There's three examples. You know, these are in the materials. You guys can bomb through them. Just really want to quickly go through and see the impact. Example one, you know, Sarah has compensation income of $2 million. That's compensation income. It's subject to wage withholding. You'll see after tax, Sarah's $2 million becomes a little over $1 million. So that's 100% of that $2 million is a tax cost. Now let's contrast that with example two, which is long-term capital gain. And you'll see that if we treat that $2 million as all being long-term capital gain, Sarah has an extra $400,000 in her pocket. So again, capital gain versus compensation income, to the extent you can get that long-term capital gain, that's where the tax savings can arise. And then the last example just contrasts the long-term capital gain of example two with short-term capital gain. Sure, Sarah sells stock, but she didn't hold it for more than 1 year. So you'll see that Sarah's gain is taxed at short-term capital gain rates, which are our regular rates. Employment taxes are not withheld on capital gains, but still her after-tax receipt is a little north of $1 million. So I just don't want to get into the minutiae of these, but let's just show how when you exercise that you have $2 million in options, what are you going to have at the end of the day? And really the drivers are, is it comp? How much of that is compensation? How do you avoid short-term capital gain? How do you get to long-term capital gain? And these examples just show that the dollar amount changes can be significant in if you can drive it towards long-term capital gain. So getting to Derek.
So long-term capital gain, I just to echo, and I don't mean to sound like a parrot, but long-term capital gain is better for one of other words. And so is there something else, that a seller of a security can do to eliminate the compensation income part of the transaction? Does it depend on what they own? If you could hit that a little bit.
And that's a great leading question, Derek, and it absolutely driven by what they own. And, that's where we talked about incentive stock options being, a tax-favored vehicle. And so that leads us into the next slide, that if you have the incentive stock option, there's just going into the slide, there's no compensation income on the date of grant. If you meet the holding periods that we'll talk about in the next slide, there's no compensation income when the option is exercised. And then when you sell the stock, again, if you meet the holding period requirements that we're going to talk about, you have capital gain, and the holding periods will drive you towards long-term capital gain on the difference between your sales price and what you paid to acquire the stock. So that goes to the question of how do I avoid or minimize my compensation income? The incentive stock option structure is, why they are so valuable, that your tax cost is in effect going to be at the long-term capital gain rate. Now, what do we need to do to keep that special tax treatment? And this is where, when we're talking about liquidity options, where sometimes we run into issues. First of all, there can be no transfer of the options prior to exercise. So, if you're going to structure something, hypothetically as a sale of options, that's going to cause your incentive stock option tax status to be blown, and that's going to cause you to go into the regular option rules. Also, the employee has to hold the stock for 2 years after the date of grant. of the option. So that's usually not a problem if the options have been held for a long period. The last requirement is that the stock must be held for at least 1 year after the exercise date. That's where I've seen a lot of problems arise. And again, if you violate any one of these three, you've lost that special tax status, and these incentive stock options will be taxed in the same manner as non-qualified stock options that we'll talk about next. So going to the question of how do I avoid compensation income, you know, it goes to the threshold question, what do you own? If you own these incentive stock options, you are in a position to have only long-term capital gain on your liquidity event. But there's a number of things that you can do, unfortunately, to lose that special tax status. So again, if we've talked about if you fail to meet those holding period requirements, and here we talk about a failure to meet the two-year holding period requirement from date of grant, 1 year holding period from date of exercise, if you violate those, the option will be subject to the tax rules that apply to non-qualified stock options. And if you lose that incentive stock option status, the compensation income is recognized, and there's going to be employment withholding taxes. So it comes at a great cost. So skipping ahead to, you know, what we see a lot of is non-qualified stock options, much different than the incentive stock options. First of all, there's no taxable income at date of grant, just like the incentive stock options. But unlike an incentive stock options, taxable income, compensation income, is recognized when the option is exercised. And it's going to be the difference between the fair market value of the stock on the date of exercise over the option price. Now, there's with withholding tax, employer withholding the tax. Again, if you were an employee at the time the option was granted, even if you're no longer an employee, those withholding taxes are still going to arise. And in a later slide, we're going to talk about why the employer is hypersensitive to making sure that there's proper withholding, and just not something you could hope to gloss over. Now, with a non-qualifying stock option, there's no holding period requirement, but again, to get long-term capital gain treatment, the stock itself has to have a long-term holding period. So you have to hold the stock at least 12 months or more from the date of exercise to get that 20% rate. So again, if you're in a situation where you own non-qualifying stock options, you are going to be in a situation where you do have compensation income. And if you hold for 12 months, the increase in value between the date of exercise of the option and the sale price will be taxed at the long-term capital gain rates. So just to skip over the example again, this just illustrates that Sarah has compensation income in connection with the exercise of her non-qualifying stock option.
Ed, so really, can I just ask you a question? So, Ed, if you're an executive at a tech company and you have a mix of ISOs and NSOs, and you're trying to evaluate, and you've sort of made the decision to sell, right? You've made that decision. You know you're going to have to exercise and sell. You're going to be within the hold period. You have, you know, $1 million worth of ISOs, $1 million worth of NSOs. And that seller wants to come up with a strategy. Is there a clear strategy there? And can you articulate, just given that pretty limited set of decisions, what you feel would be the best mix? They're not going to reach the hold period.
Well, I think the key, and we'll talk about this when we talk about the liquidity strategies, is, you know, what can you do in the context of an ISO to make sure that you meet both the two-year holding period, 2 year from date of grant, and the one-year holding period, 1 year from the date of exercise. Because if you blow those periods, you're going to have compensation income. So, you know, when we work with people on these strategies, you know, working with Dan and his team, you know, trying to come up with a structure where even though the client has stock options and is looking to get some liquidity, you know, you want to adopt a structure so at least there's a position to take that there's an exercise of the option and the employee continued to hold that stock for 1 year before the sales event. And again, that's a sales event for tax purposes. So, you know, we'll talk about the use of a forward contract and how that comes into play. We'll also talk about the sort of murkiness of the tax laws on prepaid forward contracts. But, you know, again, if you're just going to adopt a strategy that says I exercise the incentive stock option and sell the stock the day after exercise, you know, you've done yourself a disservice because you have walked away from the special tax benefit that attaches to ISOs.
Yeah. And just to give a real life example, I mean, someone I'm working with right now is going through the same process, has a mix of incentive stock options and non-qualifying stock options, and they're using the essentially exercising all of them, but using the non-qualifying as the sale and to use that amount to cover both the taxes and the amount that is needed in order to exercise the incentive stock options. And so, you know, therefore, at the end of this, hopefully that 1 year period will start.
And Dan, that's a great real life example. And in fact, we have a couple slides from here. We have an example on some of the cashless exercise strategies. And, you know, one trap if you have incentive stock options is that if you are doing a cashless exercise of incentive stock options, you know, part of the cashless exercise strategy is you sell stock and use the proceeds to pay the exercise price. Well, under that, you're not meeting the one-year holding period for incentive stock options, therefore creating compensation income. So again, when you do see that mix of you have some incentive stock options, you have some non-qualifying stock options, you know, you want to be very mindful of that one-year holding period that applies to incentive stock options to make sure you don't inadvertently trigger a tax that could otherwise be avoided.
That's helpful. So, and that same thing as well when the desire of the client is around a tax minimization strategy, but there are definitely some pitfalls there if you don't actually execute it correctly. So that's a great point, very technical point.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just, you know, especially when you're dealing with incentive stock options, it's you know, I like to describe those as a tax gift from the Internal Revenue Code. And, you know, you just hate to see someone, you know, without getting, you know, sort of good tax advice, just giving that gift away and having compensation income. So let's move ahead. You know, sort of the last category of we have is restricted stock. And, you know, restricted stock is a much different animal than options. With options, we saw that there was no compensation income on the date of grant, only date of exercise. But with restricted stock, the issuance of the stock itself is the compensation event. And the question becomes, if the stock is subject to vesting, which in most cases it is, when is that compensation event and what can be done to minimize that compensation element? And here we talk about the 83B election that comes from Code Section 83 and says if a stock is subject to risk of forfeiture, then you can make an election to recognize all the compensation income in connection with that issuance of stock on the date it's issued, as if those forfeitures did not apply, And the strategy there would be, you know, I'm counting on the value of the stock going up. So if I get a share of stock that's worth 100, but subject to a 5-year vesting period, and at the end of the 5 years, it's worth 1,000. Well, if I make the 83B election, when the stock is issued, I pay tax on the $100 amount. If I don't make the 83B election, I'm going to pay tax or pay compensation income on that $1,000 amount. Now, the strategy with this 83B election is that you only have 30 days to make the election from the date that the stock is issued. 30 days cannot be extended under any circumstances. So, you know, what brings me to tears is, you know, somebody whose employer gave them these 83B election forms, the employee stuck them in a drawer, pull them out 3 months later, and calls up, oh, I need to file these, but I'm being told is it too late, what can we do? And the answer is nothing. So it's one of those things where if you get restricted stock, you know, that 83B election should be the first thing on your list to get that completed, get it filled out, coordinate with the employer on getting it filed, because that can be a great tax savings strategy. So again, with the restricted stock, it's the compensation element is the difference between what you pay to acquire the stock and the fair market value of the stock at the date of grant, if you make the 83B election, or the fair market value of the stock at the date of vesting if you did not make the 83B election. And again, we have sort of a second element with the stock, that what's my holding period, when does it start? And this goes back to the 83B election. So if you're, you know, again, the holding period of the stock, you need to get over 12 months to get long-term capital gain treatment. So if you have stock that you made the 83B election, the 12-month period begins to run on the date the stock is issued. If you don't make an 83B election, the holding period starts on the date of vesting. So again, going with the strategy, I have restricted stock, I want to sell it the day after it's fully vested. How do you do that? Well, the question becomes, did you file an 83B election or not? If you filed an 83B election and your vesting period and you've held it for more than 1 year, that gain is going to be long-term capital gain taxed at 20%. If you did not make the 83B election and you vest and then sell it the next day, any gain element is going to be subject to tax at the short-term capital gain rates. So again, just a quick summary of what we have. What do you own? Incentive stock options, non-qualified stock options, restricted stock. You know, these next few slides, you know, put these in here just so you can use as a resource to say what can happen here. You know, have you held your ISO, you know, the stock for 2 years from the date of grant and 1 year from the date of exercise? If you have not, you don't get the tax benefit of the ISOs. If you have, you're going to have these long-term capital gain rates that apply, so very beneficial. Similarly, for non-qualified stock, again, use this as a guide of what are the tax consequences. Compensation income upon exercise, there's going to be employer withholding taxes if you were an employee when these options were granted. There's going to be state income tax. Again, on the sale, if you exercise, your whatever your compensation income becomes your measurement of future gain. So if you have $2 million in options, you recognize $2 million of compensation income, you turn around the next day and sell for $2 million, you don't have any capital gain because you sold at the price that you, in effect, paid to acquire it. So again, the summary with the restricted stock, again, the 83B election is where the planning is. You know, some people don't like making the 83B election because you're recognizing your compensation income before you have liquidity. So where do you get the money to pay the tax on that compensation income? You know, but if you don't, just keep in mind that your holding period won't begin to run until the vesting happens. So a very different set of circumstances. So let's quickly touch base on employer withholding taxes. And, you know, when we have this discussion, and I know, Dan, you and I have had this discussion with clients a number of times, you know, how is the employer going to know that I have this event? And the answer is, you know, there's typically a notice provision. And the problem being is if the employer does not withhold, they become personally liable for the tax. So that's where they're very protective in drafting their documents and making sure that nothing slips through the crack. So just quickly on employment taxes, you know, it's the FICA and FUTA and the withholding taxes on compensation income. When we talked about this, will arise in the context of a non-compensatory stock option and restricted stock. And what's frightening about employment taxes, if the employer fails to properly withhold, not only can the IRS go after the employer entity itself, but there's circumstances under the responsible party penalties where they can impose penalties on individuals. So, again, being on the employer side of this is a very uncomfortable discussion, especially when the IRS has come knocking and has already threatened responsible party penalties. So it's a difficult situation to be in on the employer side. That's why they're such sticklers on withholding in connection with you know, restricted stock and non-compensatory options. And again, to reiterate, even if you're a former employee, there's a clear obligation on the employer to withhold. So, you know, you can't simply say, well, I haven't worked there in 4 years, you know, they're not going to withhold. You know, the answer is yes, they are going to withhold. So going on to the next slide, Dan, I know you and I have walked through this mechanic a few times on the cashless exercise structure, and just wanted to throw a quick slide in here to talk about how it works, what you're actually doing, and you know why taxes arise in connection with a cashless exercise. So with the cashless exercise, it's answering the question, where does the employee get the money to pay the exercise price? So the fiction is that the employee exercises his options and obtains all of the identified shares pursuant to the option, and then sells part of those shares back to create the proceeds to get the exercise price. So at the end of the day, the net number of shares received is the full option exercise less the amount sold to pay the exercise price. Now, from an income tax perspective, you know, anytime you hear the word deemed sold, you know, that sale is going to have implications. So we see here that, you know, Sarah has an option exercise price. She needs to raise $300,000. So she's going to sell exercise for the full $2.3 million of stock and then sell $300,000 of shares back to pay the exercise price. So from a tax perspective, what just happened? Well, because this was a, you know, regardless of whether it's a, was originally an incentive stock option, because you sell on the date of exercise, you are negating that special tax treatment. but let's just say that she sold these are non-compensatory options. She will have compensation income of the $2 million, the value the stock received less what she paid for it. She obtains a $2 million tax basis in the stock, so when she turns around and sells, there's no longer capital gain. So there is a tax cost involved here, but again, keep in mind that most of it is going to be the compensation element. So with that, I think we've covered taxes for a good half hour. So Dan, why don't we give people a tax break, and if you want to sort of jump in and talk about a lot of the non-tax strategies that we have, and you'll see with these strategies, you know, going back to our tax menu, you know, where we need to step back and think: do you have compensation income? Do you have short-term capital gain? How do these strategies need to get changed to get long-term capital gain?
Thanks, Ed, and I think any tax break that you're able to give people will make you a popular man. So in any case, I wanted to go ahead and talk a little bit now about some of the actual restrictions that are in place when we're talking about private company stock. Obviously, this, we're talking private company, not public, something that hasn't been registered under the Securities Act, and so we have two main categories really of restrictions. I would say number one are the restrictions under securities laws, and then number two are contractual restrictions that generally you'll see in place in some form or another in the governing documents of most private companies, especially venture-backed companies that oftentimes use what people call the NVCA forms, or the National Venture Capital Association, and that gives optionality for many different types of transfer restrictions, and different companies choose different options on the menu there. So, talking about restricted stock here, one thing that's kind of interesting is that when people talk about restricted stock, often they're talking about two different things. And unfortunately, when people talk about it in sort of the employment / tax context, and you're talking about, basically vesting stock that you'll be able to kind of earn over time, in the securities law context, when we say restricted stock, generally what we're talking about is stock that hasn't been registered under the Securities Act. In order to register under the Securities Act, I mean, that's basically, an IPO, direct listing. Sometimes it'll be by, reverse merger or a SPAC. SPACs are very popular these days as a means of ultimately getting, registering stock. And even in those in IPO or anything like that, it doesn't necessarily mean that outstanding shares, that existing shares are going to be registered. Really, it's typically new shares that are going to be registered. Sometimes some of the existing shares with these new direct listings that you see, those ones generally are existing shares that are going to be registered. But anyone who is with a private company that isn't reporting under the Exchange Act, generally you're going to have restricted stock. So the overarching exemption, now that the critical rule in all of securities laws is that no matter what, how it's done, you must have either register or have an exemption from registration for the offer and sale of securities. What is Section 4A1 of the Securities Act is the sort of the most straightforward version of this, which is it just says that you're exempt if the transaction is by a person other than the issuer, an underwriter, or a dealer. Now, the problem with this to some extent is that it's kind of hard to determine whether or not someone is going to be an underwriter, and therefore people tend to look for more specific or more well-defined exceptions from selling. The So what do people use when they're selling restricted stock after the company has gone public? Well, usually you'll see people use what's Rule 144. Rule 144 works well for, potentially anyway, for people who hold stock that continues to be restricted, but the company is public. And what it does is there's really two different sets of rules that apply here under Rule 144. One is, are or are you not an affiliate of the company? So how this would work is different if you're an affiliate. And number two is whether or not the company is actually public. And so it doesn't, the stock in this instance isn't necessarily registered itself, but the company is a reporting company under SEC and SEC rules and regulations. So I think one thing that's important to know here, and this does track through a number of different securities laws, is who is an affiliate? Now, an affiliate, the definition is fairly broad, which is any person who directly or indirectly through one or more intermediaries controls or is controlled by or is under common control with an issuer. And control is also fairly broad here, which is basically the power to direct the management and policies of the issuer. And it doesn't matter how that control arises. And so generally, anyone who is an executive officer or a director or 25% stockholder presumptively will be an affiliate of a corporation. And there may be other people who are key employees or officers who maybe aren't executive officers. For example, people who are in charge of a business division or something else along those lines, who still might be deemed affiliates for these purposes. So for public companies, the way that this would work generally is you have a six-month holding period for the securities. And that holding period, if you hold options, the holding period begins when the purchase price for the options has been paid in full. So a lot of times where, you know, issues may come up here for in terms of the holding period are, you know, number one, did you just hold it as an option and then exercise, then you have that holding period, it hasn't yet started. But also if you've financed the purchase of the options, essentially until you've gone ahead and paid that down, then the holding period still hasn't started because you haven't paid that in full. So, and there are a number of other complicated rules regarding the holding periods here. If it's a public company, then the current public information generally has to be available. And if you're an affiliate, then there are a number of other restrictions. Generally, there's a limit on the amount that you can sell within a three-month period, which would be 1% of the total amount outstanding or based off of the average weekly trading volume. So there are a number of formulas you can use for that. The transaction itself must be made in a certain manner, which would be either a broker transaction through a market maker or a riskless principal transaction. Either any version of which you need to kind of go through a registered broker dealer, and you have a Form 144 filing requirement. But at the end of the day, this is sort of, you know, if you're holding after the IPO and you continue to hold the restricted stock, generally this is what people would do. They would go through the quote unquote legend removal process. Using Rule 144, and then after the legends have been removed for a public company, then the shares basically become freely tradable. On the other hand, for private companies, that's generally not the case. And they're, you know, and obviously the shares would continue to be restricted. So ultimately, there's a lot of information requirements that's required to be included, including a fair amount of financial information and things like that generally private companies aren't going to make available. And so, you know, what is the most popular option usually for being able to resell shares? then really isn't available for the most part for private companies. So how did we, what do we do now? Well, there's usually for these private company resales, what people tend to rely on is not actually a section of the SEC securities law at all, but rather something that's developed from case law over time called Section 4A1 and a half, or sometimes just called 4-1 and a half. The point of this is that what it's supposed to look like is the transaction itself looks like a private placement by the company, except it's not the company that's selling. It's a person who already holds shares who's selling, oftentimes that person being an affiliate, such as officers and directors and whatnot. So there are a number of precautions that generally are taken when you're relying on this resale exception, including that the notice to the buyer that the securities aren't registered and can't be resold, and making sure that they know that there are the transfer restrictions in place. To the extent that there is information available that is allowed to be made available, generally that would be provided, unless of course the people who would be the purchaser already have access to that type of information. Restrictive legends on the shares. The purchaser should be an accredited investor, which for individuals generally is going to be somebody who either has a net worth of greater than $1 million together with their spouse, or has a net income of greater than $200,000 for the last 2 years, or $300,000 with your spouse, with a reasonable expectation that you'll still meet the income threshold this year. For entities, generally, it's entities that have $5 million of assets and above. And of course, there need to be various representations and warranties that get made in connection with that. Sometimes an opinion of counsel will be required depending on the circumstances, and sometimes the company itself may go ahead and require that, since they have their own obligation to ensure that people aren't acting as an underwriter and aren't broadly distributing their shares. And so, once again, similar to the withholding issue, the company has a kind of a vested interest in making sure that this is done right. And so therefore, they often will be involved in the process in some way or another. Just quickly mentioning, there's also this Section 4A7. It is a safe harbor, and part of what's good about this one is that you're also exempt at the state level automatically if you follow it. That said, there are some informational requirements here that and therefore it's still, even though the intent of Congress was for this to basically codify 4A1 and a half, it went a little bit above and beyond, and people are still using 4A1 and a half as opposed to the new safe harbor. A couple of other limitations that the company will be concerned about, or that you should be may be concerned about. Number one is under the Exchange Act, a company needs to go ahead and become a reporting company, basically start filing periodic reports, if it has greater than 2,000 record holders of its securities, or 500 who aren't accredited investors. Now, one of the good things about this is that compensatory awards generally aren't going to count towards that 2,000 record holder number. However, once those shares get transferred, then at that point, whoever is the transferee would count against that limit. And so companies that have a lot of diffuse holdings, despite the fact that they're private, will tend to pay close attention to this. In addition, there are insider trading laws apply to private sales just as well as they do to public sales. And so that's something else to look at especially when there may be a disparity of the amount of knowledge regarding the security that the seller has versus the buyer, or vice versa. So, you know, for example, trading on the basis of material non-public information could be a, you know, something that, may trigger liability here. Outside of the securities law restrictions, there are generally a number of, contractual transfer restrictions that a company may have in place. So the most common one being the right of first refusal, which typically there would be a 30 or so day period where usually the company would have the ability to go ahead and purchase the shares. Sometimes also the stockholders have the ability to purchase the shares if the company passes. There are lockup agreements, which is typically when a shareholder has a major holding or is an officer or something else along those lines, and the company is thinking about doing an IPO. Generally, the underwriters are going to, require the key persons to enter into these lockup agreements that prevent people from being permitted to resell their shares until a certain period of time after the IPO, which usually is 180 days, subject to various extensions and things like that. Tag-along rights, which I think are, becoming a little bit less common these days, especially for, common stock, essentially give other people the right to participate in your sale. So if you know, I'm selling 100 shares and somebody else says that they want to also sell one other person to make it easy, well, then I'm actually only going to be able to sell 50 of my shares and they're selling 50 of their shares all on the same terms. Bylaw restrictions are something that's actually become a little bit more popular, so these basically the bylaws of the corporation itself would say that any transfer needs to be approved by the board of directors. One thing that idiosyncrasy is that oftentimes they only get instituted later in, a company's life, and a bylaw restriction typically will not be effective as to somebody who acquired the shares before that restriction went into effect, unless they approved the bylaw amendment themselves, and then issue or process letters, which you know helps the issuer kind of manage the process for a secondary. So sometimes they will require a certain additional period of time to be able to look at things, or they may require some fee to cover expenses or things along those lines. And so, there are a number of ways that, we try to solve for these transfer restrictions. I think the primary one and the most straightforward one is that generally when you see these purchase agreements, they're going to be contingent upon making it through the ROFR process or getting the consents or whatever else is needed and whatever processes you need to go through. And so ultimately the buyer will wind up purchasing if everyone passes on the ROFR process. But if somebody does exercise, well, you're still selling your shares. It's just you're, instead of selling your shares to the buyer on the terms that are set out in the purchase agreement, you're selling to whoever exercised the ROFR on the terms that are set out in the purchase agreement. So to some extent, it winds up the same, similar for the seller, but it does create a little bit of risk for the buyer. And so therefore, sometimes that gets priced into things. In addition, forward contracts, and Ed will talk about these a little bit more in just a minute, but basically agreements to go ahead and sell shares in the future. There also can be synthetic arrangements where you agree to for someone to have the economic rights or you basically enter into some type of a swap with respect to the shares, so somebody has the ability to get that the benefit of owning the shares without ever actually transferring the shares, and then option finance, which is something that was kind of mentioned before, not necessarily solving for transfer restrictions, but solving for how do you go ahead and actually exercise any options that you may hold. There are third parties that do this, but in addition, oftentimes we'll see the buyer go ahead and essentially loan the amounts for the exercise, so that way they don't you don't have to go through the cashless exercise process. You wind up with fewer shares to sell. So flip it over back to Ed to talk just a couple minutes about forwards at the end of the presentation.
That's great, thanks. And you know, the issue that you have with a forward contract and sort of the definition of the prepaid forward contract is on the screen. Forward contract, you agree to sell somebody shares of stock on a future date. And the question becomes, well, what happens if instead of settling the forward contract and paying the cash at the end of the period, what if the buyer pays cash at the beginning of the period? So, for example, on March 1st, Dan and I enter into a contract where I'm going to buy 100 shares of stock that he owns, and he's going to deliver that to me a year from now, but I pay him for that, and I get all of the benefits of the any dividends that are paid. He can't vote the shares unless directed by me, and he gives me the shares to hold as a security until the contract becomes. Under those facts, you're sort of laughing and saying, well, you know, what does Dan still own? You know, he delivered the stock, he got his cash, he can't do anything without my consent. You know, he owns bare paper title. Well, that obviously is not going to fly from a tax perspective. The risk there is that the IRS comes in and say, well, the sale date for tax purposes is March 1st. You don't have long-term capital gain. To the extent you had an ISO, you've blown that. So that becomes problematic. So there's really no bright line guidance on this. We do have a couple of cases and some revenue rulings. And the gist of these rulings is that if under the contract, what the seller is required to deliver is unknown, so it's subject to variables, the tax event occurs when those variables are solved. So going back to the example, if you know I was required to deliver or Dan was required to deliver 100 shares a year from now, it's clear what Dan is obligated to deliver. But if there's a formula price or different contingencies depending upon what the share price is at the end of the forward contract on the delivery date, that may provide some grounds to say, well, the tax event does not occur until that later date. So when you're looking at a forward contract, you have to be very sensitive to when does the sale occur and how tight is that obligation imposed on the seller to deliver a fixed number of shares versus a formula price. So, you know, it goes back to, you know, what do you own, and then what have you done? And that forward contract where you say, even though I have continued to have bare legal title to the stock, the IRS can come in and say, well, no, you actually sold that stock when you signed the forward contract and got paid. Again, short-term capital gain treatment can arise, turning ISOs into compensation events, you know, all those things we talked about at the beginning that you know, you really need to be sensitive of. So, you know, Derek asked what can we do to, you know, tax minimization strategies. You know, really what it comes down to is, you know, when the tax laws give you a gift, you know, don't give it away. So Dan, why don't I kick it back to you to wrap up on liquidity structures, and then I think that'll bring us to the hour.
Yeah, and just super duper fast. You know, there are a number of ways that we go about trying to you know, create liquidity in manners in private sales. So for example, we have you know, the traditional secondary sales and forward contracts that were discussed. Oftentimes, in addition, there are people who will go ahead and basically put together a fund that is created for the purpose of acquiring shares of stock of a particular company. And so it can also be an alternative from time to time. Typically, there'll be some type of approval from management in order for them to do so. But what they can do at that point is then make tender offers and things like that for the shares of the company. There are a number of issuer-sponsored liquidity solutions as well that sometimes companies do have in place, and partly because they do have, these vested interests in making sure that there aren't too many stockholders, that they're able to withhold properly, that all the taxes are done right, that everyone's complying with securities laws, and in addition, that the sale price doesn't get too far out of whack with internal valuations, which can create other issues that we don't need to discuss. So in those circumstances, what we do see sometimes are either tender offers or share repurchase programs where the company will go ahead on a periodic basis offer to repurchase certain people's shares, or a structured liquidity program through a private either a broker or matching service or private quote unquote private exchange. So those are a few of the alternatives that go ahead and allow the company to sort of manage its own process to an extent. And with that, I think we're about done. I'll hand it over to Emma.
Thanks, Dan. This concludes today's webinar. A recorded version of the presentation will be available on the Pulse Nelly website within 24 hours. Thank you for your participation.